Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Welcome back to Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us. And this weekend, we are going to be talking about a variety of different areas that intersect with the rights of children. A little bit of cultural commentary, an interview from a fertility specialist, and answering your Q&A. But as always, we start out with a little bit of Bible time. And today I am going to make a foray into waters where I don't usually swim. And that is because I have noticed a really shocking and disturbing trend on the online right, especially among conservatives and even among Christians, disparaging Judaism, the Jews, the people of Israel, and really saying that they are uniquely responsible for the death of Christ. They are even more enemies of God than just kind of your normie sinner. And talking about how the church is actually a replacement of Israel and that their time being God's people is over. So there has been so much of this swimming around my circles, or at least the followers of the people that I follow, that have been perpetuating this narrative, that I decided to really dive into it. And here's my conclusion. After speaking with a couple of people that are some Jewish scholars as well, that what we see in the New Testament in terms of Israel is the church is a spiritual fulfillment of the physical reality of the people of God from the Old Testament, that so many of the promises that God made to his people in the Old Testament are ours to claim in terms of his leading us and guiding us and protection, that we are going to operate in a spiritual economy the way that the Jews of the Old Testament operated in the physical economy, that his moral law is still equally applicable to all of us, but that Christ in his epic Jewishness fulfilled so many of the symbolic and the temple laws that had to do with our unification with Christ. And so I spent quite a bit of time looking at Romans 11 about how there is some crazy mystery going on with God's relationship with the Jews in terms of having a distinct connection with them in the Old Testament, that he did break off some of the branches of that cultivated olive tree, that we, the Gentiles, have been grafted on, and we all share the same root. Now, no Jew is going to enter the kingdom of heaven without recognizing that the Messiah of Christ is the one that they are waiting for. But there is something divine and mysterious that's going to happen in the end of the age, where, according to Romans 11, all of Israel is going to be saved. I don't know what that's going to look like. I'm just saying that God is not done with the Jewish people. As always, I have Josh Wood, my executive director, here to chat about some of what's happening in the world. But first, Josh, I'd love to hear your take on what you see in terms of scripture and what it reveals to us about the role of the Jewish people today and in the future.
Well, you did dive into some deep waters here. I think it's a good practice to be certain about the things Scripture is just abundantly clear about, and then to also be clear about the things that Scripture is not totally, does not speak clearly to. Again, I think sometimes God leaves some things or gives multiple opinions on a certain issue for a certain reason, that there's sometimes a lack of clarity on purpose for certain things. So one of those things that I would say is, there's a lot of people making very strong assumptions on, is the state of Israel, the nation state of Israel, that group that the Bible talks about. And again, I think, I don't know. Is there a remnant within the Holy Land now of Jews that God is talking about? Would he be referring right now to the nation state? Again, I'm like, I think there's maybe just a lack of clarity on what that means. And so I think a lot of people's angst or opinions on this issue go towards political decisions that may be made from the nation state of Israel. And so I want to separate that and say that might not be true. But I would say something you nailed. I know that everyone comes through the Lord Jesus Christ. They'll all bend the knee. I know that beyond a shadow of a doubt. I don't know the manner in which God is going to accomplish that. But I do know that's his desire for everyone. And this, and Israel will be no different in God's desire for them. But I agree, the Bible does seem to take a particular interest in Israel and his people. And God, we can't escape the fact that there's something unique and, like you said, mysterious to the fact that of all the cultures and societies, God incarnated himself as a man that was a Jew. And so, I mean, I take all those points and I'm like, that's the thing we're trying to piece together. I don't think it's so clear. And I think anytime someone comes very clearly to you and says, I understand it and this is it, I think you got to be careful. Those people who have that level of certainty are often dangerous people. So be clear about what you do know, but I think leave some room for God to work this out too.
Well, I appreciate the exhortation to be clear on what God is clear about. So should you encounter one of those voices that say, the Jews killed Jesus, your answer is nope, I did. I killed him. I am responsible. He came for me. And honestly, it's loser theology to say that somebody else did it, and it exempts you from the responsibility that you have and the debt that you have to pay that Christ paid for you if you're going to offload the responsibility of Christ's death onto the shoulders of another people group. We did a little Bible time. We're going to do a little bit of culture time now. So something really interesting happened last Saturday. Saturday Night Live aired a very interesting skit called New Parents, where they had two gay guys come in with a baby in like a car seat carrier and say, hey, here's our new baby. And the heterosexual couples in the room were shocked.
Oh my gosh, whose baby is that?
Excuse me? It's ours.
Wait, but how?
Okay, I'm sorry, but gay people can't have a baby?
Yeah, but like, where did it come from?
Excuse me?
Excuse me?
Wow, you are not allowed to talk like that.
That is so invasive.
Okay, but like, we were with you last night and you did not have a baby.
Where is your baby from?
Us!
But how did you get it?
And they asked what most people would ask. Things like, where did you get that baby? Whose baby is that? Where is your baby from? And the whole sketch is along the lines of the guys going, how dare you ask us that question? Nobody would ask you that question if you guys had a baby, and yet we two gay men have a baby and you want to know where it came from and who the mother is? Oh my goodness, you sound like a Republican. Why are you so obsessed with knowing where our baby came from? Now, the sketch is funny because two men cannot have a baby. But the reason why we're talking about it here is there really does seem to be a significant vibe shift happening in the country. When you look back over the last decade or two of pop culture and certainly media like sitcoms, you know, shows like Modern Family, it always depicts gay couples as not just like moral, but stable and maybe even more emotionally intelligent, with children who are better adjusted than the children of the heterosexual couples in the show as well. So now we're seeing one of the leaders of comedy, in essence, poke fun at gay couples who have acquired a child. And I think it's pretty remarkable. I think it's a sign that we're seeing a bit of a change of temperature in the country overall. Josh, what were your thoughts on this Saturday Night Live skit?
Well, what I love is that when they say things like belong, where'd you get that? What they don't maybe even realize that they're doing is they are articulating that there is a standard. Again, you have to kind of like step back and go, yeah, you're right. In order for you to have this child, someone had to lose something. And I so appreciated that they're even in their questioning, they're making that clear.
Yeah. It's so funny because Saturday Night Live has toyed a little bit with this in the past. You know, they had a skit about a year ago of two gay guys. One of them was the same actor in this current skit called We're Trying. And, you know, somebody said they made an announcement that they are, you know, going to have a baby or they're going to try to have a baby, this heterosexual couple. And then the gay couple goes, well, we're trying too. And all of the other people in the room are like, how are you doing that? And they're like, well, you know, we're just going to give it a try and we're going to see what happens. And so Saturday Night Live has been playing around the edges for a little while, to their credit. And these jokes land with people. Why? Because for the first time, we have been able to ask questions that it has been verboten to ask over the last couple decades. Really ordinary things like, where is the baby's mother? Or how might the two of you who do not have a uterus create that baby or conceive that baby? And no amount of quote unquote trying to have a baby is going to get you a baby. So to me, I look at this and I'm like, I think the spell has broken. I think that we are now allowed to say and ask the kinds of questions that you would have been so socially penalized for in the past. And if Saturday Night Live can make these jokes, I think it's an indication that a lot of us feel like we can speak more freely now.
It's interesting if you even take, what are the three, I would think of three lies right off the bat that I could name that I feel like the cover's coming down and it's beginning to be appropriate to ask questions. Number one, men playing girl sports. I mean, I think that was one. Gender transition for minors. And now this creation and this cut and paste option that children are just accessories you can put with anybody you want. And it matters not where they came from, who gave birth to them. It doesn't matter who created them, who donated this, that we're just going to be able to assemble whatever parts together we want and give them to whoever we choose. It's interesting to me that for some reason, society, again, you could maybe quibble with this. It seems like it kind of went gender transition for minors. Detransitioners who grew up and started telling their story was the first ones to say, no, I get to speak about this. I'm that person, so you can't debate me. And then it went to girls or men in girls' sports. And it was the most egregious examples of traumatic brain injuries and things like that, that like, oh my, or people being forced to change around men. And now I feel like the last one to fall seems to be this commoditization of children, ripping them away from their biological parents to give them to adults that really want them badly. And I wonder, do you think that has something to do with the age of the victims? Or the willingness to tell stories? What do you think that is?
It's hard to know because we don't have a whole lot of children of gay couples that are willing to share their story, at least publicly. So I don't feel like people have been able to actually hear the harm that kids have faced. But you see two men holding a shivering infant in a hospital bed that has very clearly just been taken away from the only person that they know to go home to a motherless house where they are going to be starved of maternal love. And there is something gut level instinctual that everyone says, this is wrong. I don't like it. I know that it makes me sound like a bigot or homophobic, but that is wrong. And so I do think that the transgender madness has, in essence, trained people up, allowed their kind of conflict muscles to flex just a little bit and allow them to say, even if this is going to ruffle some feathers, I have to say, this is wrong. There are some victims here. Now, we are seeing a bit of a decline for the support for a same-sex marriage, down from a high at about 80% to closer to 70% now. My guess is in certain areas of the country, it is much lower than that, because I do feel like the woke spell has broken and people feel like, you know what, I went along with that for a long time, but mainly it was not because I believed in it. It was because you emotionally coerced me into supporting something because there was such a high degree of social cost if I didn't go along. But that wasn't a heartfelt change. That was a, I don't want to get in trouble and I'd like to keep my job kind of change. So now that we do have a little more room to speak freely, thank you for the censorship rollback that happened on a lot of social media platforms, and because of the overall vibe shift in the country, I think people are willing to say, actually, I oppose that.
Yeah, you do have to think, anytime your ideology is living off of the ability to ban everyone else who, you know, you think about, well, you can't even counsel someone against being gay. You can't even suggest to a child that they don't have to transition their gender. You can't provide it. Anytime that's what your ideology needs to continue surviving, this kind of censorship, you know you're in, you know, hot water.
Well, reality is making a comeback, and even Saturday Night Live can't ignore it. Stay with us. We'll be right back with an incredible interview you don't want to miss.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
One of the things that we try to do here during this hour of your weekend is to equip you to start thinking about major areas of marriage and family, parenthood, reproductive technologies that perhaps you haven't thought about before. One of the ways that we do that was to try to expose you to expert voices, people that have something to say in these areas that maybe you don't have access to. So we're going to bring you an interview that we did with Dr. Whitaker, who is the founder of RRMacademy.org. And she is going to talk with you about alternatives to IVF. She's going to talk to you about restorative reproductive medicine, which is a way of addressing infertility problems where you get to the root cause and heal the body so you can have babies without the help of a lab technician. This is a growing area of medicine because so many people are looking for alternatives to IVF. And she specializes in the Cretan model of fertility care and NAPRO technologies, natural procreative technologies. She's focused on women's restorative reproductive medicine, compassionate healthcare, and education. And that's exactly what we hope you get from this interview with Dr. Whitaker, an education about how to align your bodies in ways that will allow you to get pregnant on your own and steer clear of the predatory fertility industry.
Well, we'd love to just hear a little bit of your background, how you got started in the field of medicine that you practice. And yeah, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So since I was really young, I wanted to become a physician. I really wanted to address the mind, body, soul, and the whole family unit aspects of healing. So I was really drawn to be a healer. And so I went to medical school. And during medical school, I became a mother. And during that experience, I had less than compassionate care through that process. And then just a few months later, I did my OBGYN rotation, and I realized I wasn't alone with the less than optimal care that women's health brings. And I saw it over and over, just kind of a lot of callousness and cookie cutter approaches. And then I was at Creighton Medical School actually for my training. And that's where this whole system was developed actually. So I accidentally stumbled upon that because I was at that medical school. And so I saw a contrast between two different approaches, kind of the regular approach, cookie cutter, it just kind of reflected back to my experience, seeing what was happening to others. And it hit home for me. It really felt like I could feel what they were going through, and I could really empathize with that experience. And I really wanted better. I wanted more compassion, both for the woman and her unborn child, just to really respect both patients. And so as I was going through my rotations, I saw, okay, here you drive up to the women's health menu and you get either, you know, option A, B, or C, IUD, birth control, or, you know, pills or whatever else on the menu versus the NAPRO physicians I was training under. They had people flying in from all over the world to get this very unique care that was individualized to them, very complicated surgeries and workups. And I just saw such an interest. It was just so interesting. I also was really bored by that ABC menu versus we're going to combine the really complicated endocrine system and the complicated surgical system to find all these things and correct them and heal women and really, I mean, it transformed them. And it's this unique care that is not done. People are flying in from around, literally around the world. People from Poland. I remember someone from Poland. I'm from Poland. My parents are from Poland. So that really, really impacted me. And I originally was like, oh man, that's going to be a lot. I don't know if I want to do that. But again, I thought, well, if I'm going to be away from my family, you know, doing this work, because I had just become a mother, and then I was like, oh, you know, do I really want to commit to this OBGYN field that's known to be extremely demanding? Or should I just look into something like dermatology? Just do a, you know, 9 to 1, 3 days a week. But then I thought, if I'm going to be away, I want to really do something impactful and different. And so that's really what convinced me to do this kind of work.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that. For our listeners who may not be familiar with NAPRO, restorative reproductive medicine, can you just give an overview of what that approach is? Sometimes people hear that it involves cycle charting and their mind immediately goes to the rhythm method and they're like, oh, that's that crazy thing that my grandma did for birth control and she had 8 kids. Or, you know, sometimes it's a couple that has been struggling with infertility and they hear that and it makes them think of the times that they've been told, oh, just relax, stop stressing about it, go on vacation and it'll happen. So for our listeners, just what does that approach really entail? What's going on there?
Sure. So in the 60s, when the birth control pill was invented, the really advancement in women's health kind of stopped. Everything turned into here's the pill for this, here's the pill for that. Same thing happened when IVF was invented. Oh, you have infertility, here's IVF. So there was a subgroup of people that weren't happy with that approach, that wanted something else. And so Dr. Hilders, who developed the system, he had women who were charting their cycles formally with instruction. And the ones that came to him who were avoiding pregnancy without and not having issues conceiving had a normal looking chart. And then the women who came to him with issues getting pregnant had a very abnormal cycle chart. And so he kind of changed the system a little bit to make it a little more scientific and objective, how they wrote down their symptoms. And so this objective data is very scientific now, and it can be used for research. It can be used for an individual workup and evaluation, and it can be used for targeted testing and treatment as well. So it's actually a very advanced way of seeing what's going on, starting with the cycle chart and building upon that. Now, the reason why the pill, what else? Okay, so one reason why the pill and IVF kind of stunted the growth and development of women's health is that we have blinders on as to what is going on in the women's cycle. So most OB-GYNs don't really understand the whole physiology actually of the women's cycle. I learned more about the women's cycle in my 1-hour introductory session to the Creighton Model System, which is a formal instruction of the Creighton Model system. I learned more about the physiology in that session than I did in medical school or in my residency. So that's a big problem. So we have blinders on. So we don't know, and most of physicians and healthcare does not understand the women's cycle. So the key event of the women's cycle is ovulation. And so we can't really do good research or treatments that are individualized without truly understanding that cycle. So by truly using scientific data, which show what hormones are doing, the fertile window, and what is normal, we can run tests and treatment based on that. And that improves research. So we can use that to restore health. We took the blinders off. We see what's going on in each individual woman because she is able to understand her body, bring that cycle data to her physician. So I'm trained in interpreting that data. So a woman charts on her own, brings the data to me. As soon as she walks in the door, I have an idea of what's going on, what we're thinking of as far as diagnosis, based on her symptoms and her cycle chart, which is basically like a vital sign, right? Even the OBGYN Society, ACOG, acknowledges that the menstrual cycle is a vital sign of a woman's health. So just like you go to a cardiologist and get an EKG, you go to an OBGYN and you should bring them your cycle chart. And that's going to give them a ton of data to start from to see, okay, it could be PCOS. These are the labs. These are the tests that you need. These are some things I'm thinking of. Let's go from there. And usually, even that first visit, women feel so heard and listened to. And it's so sad because they've been to 5, 6, 7 plus providers, have had multiple surgeries or procedures, are told, just do this, just do that. And so they feel like a dead end. You know, they've hit a dead end until they come. And they just feel so relieved instantly.
Now, as you've built, you know, your RRM Academy, your presence on social media, you know, you're reaching people who weren't familiar with this approach before, including, you know, potentially some IVF doctors. how has your work been received overall? Have you, have you been hearing from people who hadn't heard about this before, found a new option that is working for them? Are you hearing from doctors who are interested in this approach who maybe hadn't been exposed to it in their medical training? And tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I was really nervous because I felt like I was coming in with a completely different perspective and I would be harassed. I was worried about that. You know, I mean, I think everyone is on social media, especially if you're different. And so I'm so, you know, looking back now on when I started, I believe in 2018, 2019, I've really overwhelmingly had just such a wonderful experience and it's been extremely rewarding. And that's what keeps me going. Most people on social media are there to either get clients, get money, you know, make money. I'm there because I get these messages frequently. They're typically very long with a really sad story of their background and how many things have failed them. Either IVF has failed them or the system has failed them. So they feel like something's not right. And they're messaging me, like, you know, I read something on your page or your page gives me a hope or what if I have this or where do I go next? So frequently I get that. And then they'll come back a few months later, or a year later and say, I was able to conceive because I asked my doctor to run this test just to check for infection or whatever it is. I asked my IVF doctor to do this and I was able to conceive naturally or whatever the story is, you know, and that keeps me going. So the vast majority of messages I get are experiences and mainly heartache, and it just makes, you know, me hurt for them and continue to advocate for them through education so they can empower themselves. That's the main point of my page. And so, but in the process, I do really want to include citations and my clinical experience, not to promote me or my work, but hopefully other physicians can see the good outcomes and how rewarding it is and how happy these patients are to feel better, for example. So some may not get a baby or may not get a baby right away, but they're so happy to have answers and have healing, have improvement of their validation of their pain and symptoms, a reason for their infertility so they don't blame themselves, and hopefully a baby, which does happen quite frequently. We do have high success, but, if you read the comments, you can see women will share their story, which is just so amazing. And that's, my page is such a great place for these women to share their stories to help others. And I'll see them helping each other in the comments and who knows what else has happened behind the scenes, but it's a great place for women who want to advocate for themselves for a different way to be able to empower themselves, connect with other women, and support each other. And hopefully also, I try to throw in some emotional support too, to not feel desperate, to live your life. You know, messages that aren't on social media, right? The opposite. It's like fear tactics to get viral videos and you can't touch this, you can't eat this, or, you know, it's toxic and you're ruining your eggs or whatever, who knows. You know, I'm trying to kind of bring the opposite, from fear, but hope. But yeah, I've had a couple doctors who do IVF. I've connected with them. They've asked me how to do the selective HSG tube study, or these women will message me and they're like, my doctor's never heard of this. So they'll bring the research to their doctor. So I'm hoping it's harder for me to educate physicians. It just throughout my career, I've noticed they tend to just, this is what the medical society does, tells me, and this is what I'm going to do. But hopefully with these women that can advocate for themselves, they're the ones that I think can advocate for themselves, educate the physicians, and then hopefully come back to them pregnant and saying, hey, this is what worked for me. And hopefully that their cases will speak for themselves.
Do you feel like you're seeing an uptick in fertility specialists that are more leaning the direction you're talking about, that they want to be more investigative and more holistic in care? And if you go to different conferences and are you networking and get, like, are there more and more doctors that are sort of in that, on that side of things? Or do you feel like you guys are kind of, you're a minority and it's hard to find each other if you're at a conference?
I don't go to the fertility conferences, the IVF conferences. First, I don't do IVF, so it doesn't apply to me. And most of their research is IVF. So it's kind of this echo chamber. We basically all go to echo chambers, right? Like I go to restorative fertility conferences, or I'll go to surgical conferences. So we're all in our echo chamber. We're in our surgery. My bias for surgery, I tell patients that too, right? Like I like to fix things. I often fix things in surgery. So that's my tool. So that's my bias. But I think it's wonderful. But, you know, I'm honest with them. And so, yeah, I'm in an echo chamber, I guess, of surgery, though. The minimally invasive gynecologic surgery conferences that I go to definitely don't focus on fertility. It's totally like, so in women's health, you're either an infertility patient or you're a pelvic pain patient. There's no overlap. You can't be in a pain patient that has infertility. That doesn't work. So, but for me, I combine symptoms with infertility. So to me, it's very important to address both. So that's a really important thing that no one would think about, right? That doesn't make sense, but that's how separating the pill and IVF, we separate symptoms and pain from fertility. When, if we address pain early on, we could likely prevent infertility. But yeah, so yeah, I go to restorative conferences or I'll go to surgical conferences. Going to the infertility conferences typically are focused on IVF and just IVF research. It's just kind of like the pill. The pill's reinvented every 10 to 20 years when the patent expires. Same with IVF. It's just all like pretty similar research. It's just kind of boring, honestly. There's not a, you know, despite what it sounds like this innovative technology. Well, it's not really going anywhere, and the success rates aren't going to really improve over time unless they start adding restorative approaches on top, which yes, some doctors are doing that.
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com. Once again, here's Katie Faust.
Welcome to our final segment at Them Before Us Radio. We hope that you have feel informed a little bit more about what's happening in the world of big fertility and the ways to heal your body so that you can get pregnant on your own rather than circumvent your natural systems by using reproductive technologies that are so often bad for women and bad for children. We hope that you've seen a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel in terms of how culture is changing when it comes to the SNL skit about asking questions about where these two men got the baby from. But the main thing that we're focused on, the thing that we care the most about is you and your life. What's happening in your world? How can you do things in ways that best align with child rights and well-being? So we try to do that at the end of every radio show by addressing the questions that you have sent in over the past week. To help me, I have Jen Friesen, who is our Them Before Us training director, who has been gathering your questions and is going to pitch them to me now and also probably add quite a bit in terms of great content because Jen herself is a subject matter expert on all things Them Before Us. Welcome to the show, Jen.
Hi, Katie. Thank you so much for the compliment. I've learned a lot from you, and it's really fun doing social media and the podcast because I hear from a lot of folks, a lot of different comments and questions. We got this question from social media recently, and it's very interesting, so I'd love to have your take on it. It's a woman wondering if it's okay to do surrogacy or use a surrogate for your own leftover embryos, assuming there's some medical actual reason you cannot carry the children, or is it better to adopt them out? What do you think?
Yeah, so I know of a situation where a woman who was Christian, incredibly pro-life, created five embryos, had the absolute conviction that she was going to implant all five of them. And then what happened is after her first pregnancy, she had cancer and she had to have a hysterectomy. So now she's got four embryos that are left and she loves those children. She recognizes that they are little lives. But what do you do now? I mean, the options in any direction are going to involve some level of loss for the children. Either she freezes them perpetually, or she donates them to research, or she thaws them and discards them. And this is something that she was not comfortable with at all because she recognized these are little lives. So that's unacceptable. So now what are the other options? She can either adopt the embryos out so that somebody can implant them in their womb and then raise them through adulthood. But in those situations, the child is going to lose that daily connection with their biological mother and father. So another option is she could gestate the embryos in another woman's womb and then have a probably commercial arrangement where she would pay the woman to hand over the children to her so that she could raise her own biological children. But now you've got children who are experiencing that primal wound, that interruption of that bond between mother and child that has developed over the course of 9 months. And so it's almost like pick your brokenness. At this point, you just have to pick what kind of brokenness the children are going to experience, either the brokenness of being separated from their biological parents or the brokenness of losing their birth mother. So I don't know how to evaluate which of those is better and which of those is worse, but I will say that this is why at Them Before Us, we don't think embryos should ever be frozen, because very often, even if the adults have the best intentions, when a child goes into the freezer, there are all kinds of things that will make sure they never come out. And this woman has faced, and I think our questioner has faced, one of the most crippling scenarios where they've learned that to be, unfortunately, very true.
Yeah, it seems, okay, so if we think about the ideal for a child is to be raised by their biological mother and father so they don't lose that genetic connection, their biological identity. Some people could probably argue if you used a surrogate and then you brought the child back into your home, at least they would have that. So it does seem like in an impossible scenario, that might be one of the better options versus being adopted, even if it was to someone you knew, but then they're being raised without you, or do you do an open adoption scenario and all these kinds of things. But like you're saying, if you go the surrogate route, you are setting your child back in terms of attachment right from the beginning, because they're going to lose that one security they've had right at birth. And even though they're handed to their genetic parents, they don't know that you're their genetic parents. All they know is the person I knew for 9 months is not here anymore. So when they're crying out in the middle of the night, that's the person they want. So it is a really impossible situation. It kind of shows too, these are the unintended consequences of this whole industry, right? There's so many things we can't account for. She didn't know she was going to lose her uterus, and that wasn't her fault. But getting sucked into these practices or the industry means you're making these life and death decisions maybe humans weren't really supposed to be making.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this dystopic choice kind of points towards why these technologies should be avoided altogether.
Okay, for our next question, someone asks, my Instagram feed is filled with all these reels about women saying they've left their marriages or they got a divorce, but they're really happy now. So these are kind of a positive take on it. And this woman saying, I feel frustrated with my husband a lot of the time. And I feel sometimes like these women have a point, like maybe would things be better on the other side if I kind of pursue my own happiness?
Well, it's interesting because we often say it Them Before Us, and we said it in our second book about instilling a biblical worldview in your children, raising conservative kids in a woke city, that you become what you behold. Whatever it is you are looking at, you are going to become like that. And I will tell you who understands that reality. It is social media algorithms. They understand that if you're watching, for me, for example, like a late 40s woman that wants to make sure that she is getting everything out of her workouts, I'll tell you what, the algorithm knows how to feed me pictures of beautiful women in their late 40s who have like absolutely ripped bodies. And I will click on that every time. And so now when I go to Instagram, it is nothing but Instagram reels of older women who are working out at the gym. I have trained the algorithm to feed me what I'm wanting. And as a result, I have changed my workout style. I have tried to become the women that I am beholding now. I don't know if I've achieved that same level of result, but that's the bottom line, is whatever you're looking at, you're going to become like that. And so you can use that powerfully for good in terms of looking at the holy, the beautiful, the true, or that reality can wreck your life. And that's what's happening in the world of Instagram when it comes to all of these influencers. Surprisingly, they have some kind of plan or some kind of product or some kind of journal or some kind of technique or therapy that they have to offer if you do leave your husband and your children because he is holding you back, or you're not experiencing your bliss, or you're not receiving the independence that you deserve, or you don't get to be the woman that you were designed to be because You are just saddled with so much housework and he does not appreciate you. I mean, like, I have watched those reels and I will tell you, they are horrifying. Horrifying for a couple reasons. Number one, they almost always diminish the impact on the kids, ignore it, or say the kids are going to love this. What the kids really want is they want you to be happy. That is such an old lie. That is a lie that we've been using since the rise of no-fault divorce in the 70s and 80s, that kids don't need married parents. They just need happy parents. And you know what? We have generations of children whose lives have been wrecked because adults believed those lies. And now it's being recycled in sort of this feminist empowerment trend on Instagram. It's poison, ladies. It is poison. And by the way, maybe your husband doesn't do as much housework, but are you figuring out the insurance? Are you working on the security system and home protection? Are you doing the auto care? Are you doing the yard work and the lawn care? Statistically, men do more of those chores. Women do more of the vacuuming and the dishes and the food prep. And so I'm sorry if the lines don't fall perfectly along like 50-50 split, but that is no reason to leave your husband. Here's the final point. Depending on the studies that you look at, 30 to 80 percent of people regret their divorce. So all of those women who are like, I'm living my best life now. I gave up on my husband, but now look at this new hottie boy that I've got. Maybe it'll happen for you, but it's much more likely that you will look back with absolute regret that you wrecked your marriage and your children's home forever.
It's interesting because social media skews so female. I mean, even I think our followers, it's like an 80-20. I think it's like 80% of the Done Before Us. You can see some of those demographics on the inside of social media. And so it is fascinating because it's primarily women's stories that are sharing it, right? And one of our colleagues was talking about, you know, it's not necessarily representative of the people who got divorced for what we would say are more ethical reasons. My husband up and left and went with the secretary sort of thing. Though, but those folks typically aren't making an Instagram reel about it and saying, I'm so much better off now because my husband left me. And, or maybe that was what they experienced, but 5 years later, they're sharing a reel and they're like, you know, I survived my divorce. There could be some nuances there, but it does seem typically it's kind of the follow your dreams and now I'm actually happy sort of things. So that was one main thought, you know, it skews so far female. We're really kind of only seeing that half of the story. It's not typically men that are saying, I'm unhappy in my marriage or my wife's not happy and she wants to leave me. And to your point as well, men overwhelmingly do the jobs that are the most dangerous in the world. So I just picture, you know, if you're a man who's one of those oil rig guys, have you seen those where they whip the chain and it's like this crazy where if you do something, I'm so clumsy. I just picture you do one wrong move, like your limb is gone.
No, right? I would be fingerless. Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. So the majority of the most dangerous jobs in the world are men. Men are working them. And I think about, you know, we lose power all the time in this area of the country with windstorms and stuff. And if you get your power back in 24 hours, you think about that crew is statistically probably men or mostly men have worked 24/7 to try and restore. It's rain and sleet and all this stuff. All that to say, it's just, if we only look at the side where the woman feels like, hey, he's not helping me as much around the house, it's not legitimate to feel some kind of way. Hey, they're not helping me as much with the kids. But if you were also to balance it with the male perspective of, I actually worked a 24-hour shift restoring power to 2 million people in our city. And then I came home and I laid on the couch for 12 hours and I didn't help with anything around the house. You get a more balanced perspective. But we don't see that on social media is kind of the difference. So I like what you said of, if you can try to balance your algorithm or live a little more offline, get more of those perspectives and see what both sides are doing. I mean, isn't that the story of the man working outside and the woman working outside? Both think the other person has a much easier life and they sort of switch the jobs for a day and both of them feel completely overwhelmed. What am I doing? They mess it up and they kind of realize, okay, both of us are actually doing things that are really hard, challenging in their own way. And that's the trade-off you make when you're, at least you're getting to divide your labor. That's the benefit of working in a partnership.
Yeah. Yeah, ladies, you just need to be very aware. You are, by nature, more susceptible to social messaging and social contagion. You are more likely to go along with the group, especially if it's a perceived group of women that look admirable or beautiful or fulfilled. Just understand that that is sort of capitalizing and almost hijacking on a very beautiful aspect of femininity, which is pro-social behavior, you know, wanting to be a part of a group. Very, very good. Just be careful that you're trying to aspire to be part of the right group that is being faithful to your marriage, faithful to your children, and who is not taking this like me above all else mindset.
Okay, last question with our last few minutes here. This person asked, they've heard about artificial wombs and that could be a reality in the next few decades. Wouldn't this be a good alternative to things like unplanned pregnancies instead of abortion? What's the TBU take on this kind of technology?
We are incredibly concerned about the development of things like artificial wombs. Could it have some applications that could benefit children? Perhaps a situation where there's preeclampsia or some kind of reason why the mother needs to deliver and the child is not yet ready to live outside the womb. Could you transfer the child to an artificial womb and then reduce the number of weeks that they have to be in the NICU? Great. A woman doesn't want to carry the pregnancy, so then she transfers the baby to an artificial womb at 12 weeks. That's kind of like the best case scenario. Here's the problem. I don't know if a baby's going to survive that. Babies are not meant to live in machines. Part of their development is being exposed to the light and the dark, the movement, the sound, the smells, right? A lot of their muscle development takes place pushing against the walls of the uterus and the different movements of the mother. And so I don't know if artificial wombs will ever be successful, but if they are, overwhelmingly, they will be exploited because of the three things that you need to create a baby in a laboratory, sperm, egg, and womb. Wombs are the hardest thing to get to. They are the most expensive, hardest to find material when it comes to the baby assembly line. And it is very difficult to get women to agree to rent out their bodies for 9 months. That is why we find economically vulnerable women in Mexico or Nigeria or the Philippines to do it for us. It would be so much easier if we could cut women out of this gestational process altogether. And then we wouldn't really have anybody resisting us if we say, we don't like that this child is developing or has now been diagnosed with some kind of special need, and we would like to eliminate them because we don't want a cleft palate child. Sometimes the surrogate mother is the only one that says, wait a second, I love this baby. I'm not going to let you abort it. I'm not going to let you selectively reduce it. And it would be a lot easier if we didn't have an actual human female who's bonding to this baby to get in the way if we don't like the product that's developing. So I've written about this at Public Discourse. I've done some interviews about it, especially with Seth Gruber, where we go into detail. We think that this is going to be absolutely terrible for children and probably enable mass human rights abuses against the preborn. Well, that is all the time that we have for today. Thanks for being with us. Thank you for giving us an hour of your weekend to equip you into warriors on behalf of children. We will see you next week.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.